Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest today is Jan Mati Dolbaum, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Bremen and co-author of the recent book Navalny, Putin's Nemesis, Russia's Future. Thanks very much for joining me today, Jan.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
It's great to have you on the podcast. Now, before we start, I just want to mention a change in the format here. We're no longer conducting this podcast on the social network formerly known as Twitter. Instead, we're recording it in the studio. So no longer on Twitter Spaces or X Spaces, at least for the moment. Now, this is a return to past practice, but with a twist. While we won't be able to take questions live, we are inviting listeners to send questions on the topics at hand in advance. It looks like no questions have come in ahead of today's conversation, which again is the first time we've gone back to studio recording. But I encourage listeners to send questions in the future. Now, while this podcast is called The Week Ahead in Russia, we're going to focus on something that occurred on Friday, but clearly will have long-lasting consequences, and not least for the person it happened to, Alexei Navalny. The already imprisoned Kremlin opponent was convicted late Friday on charges of extremism that he and his supporters say are absurd. And he was sentenced to 19 years in a so-called special regime prison, a maximum security facility and the harshest kind of prison there is in Russia, which is saying something, something very unpleasant. These are places where people sentenced to life and those whom the state claims are particularly dangerous repeat offenders are held. Now, this seems telling in a way, I think. I mean, Navalny's protests, his political efforts, including an attempt to challenge Putin in the 2018 presidential election, and his investigative reports on evidence of corruption among high officials, people in Putin's circles, these have all been nonviolent. But what Navalny contends is that Putin and his associates actually do find him dangerous in the sense of posing a threat to their grip on power. Now, I mentioned the book, Jan, I mentioned the book that you co-authored with Morvan Laouet and Ben Noble. It's called Alexei Navalny, Putin's Nemesis, Russia's Future. And there's a question mark on that last part. And I guess that question still stands after this verdict and sentence. The book was published in 2021. That's before this extremism case was initiated, but after Navalny had been arrested that January upon his return to Russia from Germany, where he'd been recovering from a nearly fatal nerve agent poisoning in Siberia the previous August, that he blames on Putin and the Federal Security Service, the FSB. And he's, in fact, published evidence of FSB involvement in the poisoning. Yeah, now one thing I want to ask you is this. The new verdict and the 19-year maximum security prison sentence, do these developments fit in with what you've written in the book and how you believed the Kremlin's standoff with Navalny would play out? Or do they somehow come as a surprise, something unexpected? And in either way, I guess, additional question, what that might mean, what might that mean for the future in terms of Navalny and Russia?
Right. Thanks, Steve, for this question. I think we have to start, or I have to start saying that we did not predict this, and we didn't try to predict this. So we wrote this book in early 2021, as you said, after Navalny had returned to Russia and was being tried. And but before this extremism case was initiated, but we were busy keeping up with the facts on the ground in April, May, 2021, while we were finishing the manuscript, and many, many things were happening in really quick succession that we hadn't anticipated maybe to be happening so quickly. So, for example, it was then already clear that the FBK, Navalny's main organization, the Foundation Against or for the Fight of Corruption, was being listed as an extremist organization. So this it was to be anticipated that at some point there would be a case initiated against Navalny and his team on the grounds of these of this legislation. And so we didn't predict that this would happen in the way it did, but it clearly, I think, fits the trajectory on which we saw Russia back then already, and many others obviously saw Russia as well. And we tried to describe that trajectory in the book. And so we frame it in a path from an informational autocracy towards a more classical authoritarian regime. And an informational autocracy is a term that we borrow from a book written by Sergei Guriev and Daniel Treisman, who have argued that informational autocracies are sort of the modern version of authoritarian regimes that depend on much more on manipulation than on overt repression. So they depend on manipulating the people's view of the autocrats via propaganda and changing what they believe the true nature of the regime is, and making the population believe that it's actually performing well and that it's actually legitimate, rather than using so much overt repression. And Russia used to be that kind of authoritarian regime for quite a long time, and now we're seeing it moving towards the more sort of overtly repressive classical authoritarian regime of the 20th century, we would say. And I can just maybe briefly line out a sort of a case study of how that trajectory has looked. I mean, these are all things that are familiar to us and to the listeners of this podcast, but I think it makes sense to sort of look at them in a little bit more of a distant perspective and place them in a succession that really makes clear this pathway. So, for example, if we look at the foreign agent law or the previous cases against Navalny, or also his participation in the mayoral elections in Moscow in 2013, I think these are all cases where this informational capacity of Russia's authoritarian regime clearly comes out. So if we take the foreign agent law, for example, I think the main point, at least initially, was discreditation rather than strong repression, right? So this was a law that made you, as an organization, declare that you're a foreign agent if you receive any sort of foreign funding and also engage in very vaguely defined political activity. And obviously this was something that created bureaucratic troubles for these organizations that were labeled foreign agents or that had to label themselves foreign agent. And it also undermined their work, you know, in a very significant capacity. But it also really, the discreditation, I think, was the main point here. It sort of was to shape public opinion on these people. So it attached this very unpleasant label to them and discredit them in the eyes, not just of the population at large, but also of their collaborators, and make those collaborators sort of hesitant to work with them out of fear for their own reputation, right? So that was a clear application of this strategy, I think, to manipulate rather than to overtly repress necessarily, right? Mm-hmm. And also the cases against Navalny, they were clearly, I mean, they were repression in a very direct sense. I'm talking now about the Kirov Lies case and the Yves Rocher case. So these were criminal cases that were brought against Navalny. And one of them eventually led up to his first prison term when he returned to Russia in 2021, because he was sort of on parole and violated, allegedly violated the the parole conditions for this verdict on the Yves Rocher case, and that's what got him in prison in 2021. But still, these were cases that were also manipulative of public opinion, if you will, because they were not political from on the side of the regime. They were fraud cases, embezzlement cases, and sort of trying to show that Navalny is not is just like all the other people he accuses of being corrupt and of embezzling funds, right? So this was also part of the strategy, sort of to discredit him, as much as it was part of the strategy to bring him behind bars. And then the Moscow mayoral elections was also something like this. So this this was a case, is just 10 years ago, kind of even unbelievable that, that that this could happen in Russia only 10 years ago, that an overtly oppositional figure with really some public backing could be officially on the ballot. But that was the case, and that was the case because the Kremlin wanted someone on the ballot who was openly oppositional and who was sort of that. I think that was an attempt to showcase that the opposition can, they can even be on the ballot, but they don't succeed. And that was another, some, you know, obviously there were hurdles and bureaucratic troubles created for them and sort of ensured that they didn't succeed. But that was an entirely different strategy to what we see today, right? So applying the extremism law against FBK and against Navalny personally, I think is really a qualitative shift. So the regime is no longer hiding that this is a political standoff. So they're not trying to discredit Navalny by saying he's just a fraud like all the others, you know, implying that, you know, might be regime is also full of frauds. But Navalny is not better than them. So that was the idea to, you know, to discredit opposition and activism in general. And now they're saying, yeah, look, this is a political threat, and we are neutralizing that threat. And Putin has made that very clear when he just recently commented on Vladimir Karamurza's case, when he said some, I'm paraphrasing, he said something like, we're in an armed conflict, we need sort of a strong stance vis-a-vis people who are doing damage domestically. And sending by that, sending a clear signal that, you know, anything goes now, and these are political enemies, and they should be shut down. And that's, I think, a really qualitative shift that has been playing out over quite some time. And it's really now no longer using repression to shape people's perception of opposition like it was maybe done in the 2010s, but it's now really using repression to simply shut down opposition altogether. And that that reinforces what we're saying in the book, that this shift is occurring from an informational to an to a more classical authoritarian regime. Now, obviously, that trend has been going on for quite some time, right? It's not something that's altogether new since 2 or 3 years. But if you look at the Bolotnaya trials, for example, they started in 2013. That was maybe one of the first signs that this this shift was happening, when there was really heavy sentences brought against participants of this rally in Moscow in 2012. And so that that trend set in at least then and has been going on for quite some time. And it was sort of in parallel to this more, more manipulative strategy that was going on. But I think we see, you know, the weight of the repressive side of this increasing over time and relative to the more subtle manipulative side, I think. Now, now you can of course ask why do we see that trajectory, right? And that's probably a pretty long answer. I don't want to, really want to go into that. But I mean, of course, there's an increase of Siloviki with sort of a zero-sum worldview and a mindset of preventive action, I think, and sort of that increase might have spurred that that change. And
so
then
sort
also,
of, sorry to interrupt, so sort of. A shift, maybe a little bit in terms of who who's kind of influential or in power within, you know, within Putin's circles, to the more less subtle, I guess, less subtle people who, you know, from people who would be applying what I think you called informational autocracy to people who are going for strict direct repression. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. So that's one factor that might explain that, just a shift in who's calling the shots and what are their mindsets and what do they think. Then also the legitimization strategy has changed. I think also with the protests for fair elections in 2011-12, there's much more of an emphasis of this narrative of, you know, Russia's being encroached upon, not just from the outside, but also from seemingly, you know, a liberal opposition that we have to defend ourselves against and defend, you know, Russian statehood and Russian cultural identity against that. And that sort of creates a narrative that there is an enemy that has to be, that Russia has to be defended against. And that also presupposes, you know, a stronger role of repression, I think, quite logically, if you stay within that narrative. Mm-hmm. And then also maybe a third factor was also the lack of factors that helped avert such repressive developments in other post-Soviet states, right? So obviously Russia is not very vulnerable to political conditionality from the EU or from whoever. And there are also no large independent economic actors. And Putin has been very clear from the very beginning that this is not something he would like to see. And he's been very persistent in, like, Khodorkovsky was obviously the most prominent case of those, where, you know, the class of independent oligarchs was just eliminated in contrast to other post-Soviet regimes. And then also there was no geopolitical cleavage that could be mobilized against an authoritarian leader, as we saw, for example, in Ukraine or in Moldova. So all of these factors were absent. Lucan Way has called them factors that sort of create pluralism by default, so that things that create barriers to the closing of authoritarian regimes. And all of these were absent in Russia. So that's clearly an explanation or a set of factors that help explain why we see that shift, right? And then obviously for the future, because you asked about the future also, yeah. It is very hard to see how that trajectory might change or might change course. So for one thing, I think even for the repressive apparatus as a bureaucratic entity, it is difficult to change course. So there was recently, I don't know if you've seen that, there was an interview in Medusa recently by an anonymous Russian colleague who underlined that this is just a simple quantitative performance evaluation, like in many other bureaucratic entities in Russia. So, you know, if there were substantially fewer criminal cases open next year, for example, then that would count as an underperformance.
Right.
And this is not something that the repressive apparatus would like to see itself doing, right? And so obviously they also don't want many more, just from a, you know, from a perspective that also means more work.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely that there won't be any less, right? So even if the political expectations don't radicalize further, or even if they become less explicit, you know, compared to the Putin statement I quoted earlier, then from a bureaucratic point of view, the change is not likely. And then, of course, now all of these other factors that I lined out are pretty much in place and might only increase. And depending on how the Russian army performs in Ukraine, that might also, you know, make another wave of mobilization coming or less unlikely. And that will also then necessitate further repression, probably, because that will also create some sort of backlash in the population. And so there's really not much you know, to be hopeful about regarding this trend of an increasingly radical repressive trajectory.
All right. Well, thanks very much for that. It's a pretty grim, but thank you. It sounds like kind of a snowball effect. I mean, not one that increases in size extremely quickly, but one that kind of rolls along. And it sounds like, like with many things in Russia now, just the political scene in general, if it can be called that, a lot will depend on what happens in the war, in Russia's war on Ukraine. And thanks for going back. I mean, I think it's very, you know, back to 2013, Navalny's run for Moscow mayor, and the what you've pointed out has been a big shift in the way the Kremlin is prosecuting and persecuting Navalny, I guess. I had certainly noticed, of course, that in the past, until he returned to Russia in 2021 following his poisoning, before that, he had been in jail in lockups many times, you know, after protesting, you know, or detained on the street and brought to jail. But he had never been imprisoned, like convicted. And he was once convicted around the time of that mayoral election, 2013, convicted and sentenced to an at-real prison time, as they call it. But then that was reversed. Yep. You know, apparently because it seems like because they, you know, they feared he'd becoming a martyr. So I'd noticed, you know, that change from not imprisoning him to, you know, imprisoning him and increasingly long terms. But I have to say, I hadn't noticed what you pointed out, you know, was the difference, you know, these cases of fraud and embezzlement to portray him as, you know, just a sort of a common criminal or a corrupt person, to these overtly political cases culminating in this extremism case, and in fact, he apparently still faces a possible investigation and possible trial on terrorism charges, which could add to his sentence. You know, which now stands at 19 years. So thanks very much. Now, another aspect of this that I wanted to discuss is kind of the optics of the verdict hearing last Friday. Now, I watched what I guess was a video. I think it was a video of the video that journalists at the prison where Navalny is held and where the trial took place were able to watch from a room entirely separate from the makeshift, what I think was a makeshift courtroom at the prison. And the hearing was quite a spectacle. For one thing, who schedules a verdict hearing for 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon? Mm-hmm. I think journalists used to covering Russian trial hearings. I mean, I was in Russia and covered the Khodorkovsky trials. I think journalists are used to covering trial hearings that sometimes go, verdict hearings that sometimes go on for days as the judge reads out the verdict and sentence that echoes the prosecutor's case. Many of us probably suspected that the sentence might come sometime this week, not last week. But no, this hearing on Friday was over, and I believe it was less than 10 minutes. Yeah, what did you think of the way this was done? Was it essentially trolling on the part of the state, kind of an effort to send a message, in addition to the clear and chilling message sent by the sentence itself?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, clearly, I think the verdict itself was obviously curated in detail, or at least the presidential administration made sure that it, you know, that it. That there was not going to surprise anyone, right? So that this was really going to lock up Navalny for a long time. I think that is clear that this is a politically motivated and highly curated verdict. Mm-hmm. The FBK team has even done a little investigation into the judge and especially one FSB officer who was present at the trial and who, as they claim, based again on their research of phone connections and a sort of openly available or at least available data on which numbers call which other numbers, which they also used for investigating the poisoning, right? So they did another investigation of that sort, and they apparently found that this FSB officer who was present at the trial was also, or had called the judge several times before, in the weeks before the verdict, and interpret this as evidence for, you know, a clear, a very clear monitoring of the whole trial by the FSB, which, mm-hmm. you know, I obviously I can't confirm, but which is entirely plausible. So that is clear. And I don't know about how the details of the trial itself were then choreographed. And I don't have any insight on that. And we shouldn't necessarily read too much into this, into these details. But on the other hand, I think this is also, you know, how this whole trial unfolded is really testimony to the process that I spoke about earlier, that the political nature of the repression is becoming more evident, that and in that sense, maybe the fact that the judges spare everyone the effort to sit through this, you know, hours and days of reading a long and detailed verdict when everybody knows what the outcome is and what the purpose of this a trial is anyway. So maybe that is something that underlines this idea, right? And clearly, the whole setup was, you know, very telling of the direction in which the regime is moving. So all the secrecy about this trial, the blatant violations of the defendant's rights. So one of the most glaring examples, obviously, is not just the secrecy and the difficulty of obtaining any sort of information for outsiders, but also the fact that Navalny's lawyers had almost no time or few days to get acquainted with the details of the trial themselves, and then just the optics of this improvised courtroom and the people in masks, you know, standing around, and sort of all of this is clearly a very clear sign, I think, of this trajectory towards a full-blown dictatorship that is, you know, less and less willing and perhaps also less and less able to hide its nature, you know. So this is not something that is not even an imitation of a rule of law here, right? This is a clear it's a clear trial as you would expect in a dictatorship. You know, it's no more, not any more, you know, designed to create the illusion of a, you know, of a fair and proper trial, and I think in that sense this is telling. I'm not so sure about the, you know, the detail of the timing, but in general, this trial is very much conforming to the trend that we've been talking about earlier.
All right. Yeah. I mean, great point. I definitely agree. You know, it seems like in the past you've had these trials that were sort of an imitation of, you know, of justice, and now you have this. Okay, come 4 o'clock, and here it is. You know, this is obviously determined in advance, and here's what we're doing. So I think that's a great point. It actually reminds me of something that Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov apparently told the New York Times recently, and for a story that I think came out today or yesterday, about the election next year. And Peskov said that essentially election is in Russia less a democratic process. This isn't an exact quote, but costly less democracy than it is costly bureaucracy. And I think, you know, I don't know why he said that. It seems like a strange thing to say publicly, but to me it kind of conveys a similar message, that, you know, that there's less of an imitation mm-hmm. going on, less of a effort to pretend that this, you know, this is a justice system and that elections are democratic. So it's an interesting parallel, I think.
Yeah.
All right. Jan, again, thanks very much. Great insights on this very, I think, chilling case. I mean, we now have Navalny's now set to, and to be honest, I haven't heard a word of an appeal. They have 10 days to appeal, I believe. But obviously, little or no chance for a change. Sometimes they adjust the number of years. Now sentenced to 19 years, again, in a special regime prison, the harshest type of prison that Russia has. And he will have little communication with the outside world. Thanks very much, Jan, for your insights on this and for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Steve.
Okay, once again, I've been speaking to Jan Matti-Dahlbaum, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Bremen and co-author of the book Navalny, Putin's Nemesis, Russia's Future. I'll be back next Monday for another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia. As I mentioned, we are now welcoming questions sent in advance, so I encourage listeners to send questions ahead of next week's podcast if you have any. And please keep an eye out for my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which comes out most Fridays, but not this week. The next edition will be issued on August 18th. Thanks for listening.